You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
So Lisa Tansey, as I mentioned, is a graduate of this law school, one of many reasons we've invited her back. She did very well here, which meant she got high honors, magna cum laude, which very few people do at Harvard Law School. There has not been great inflation as at other parts of Harvard. She was also on the Law Review, which is another indication that she is very, very smart, in case you were wondering. She spent part of her career in fancy law firms after that, Perkins Coie, and Dorsey and Whitney in New York, I understand, right? Which is,
yes,
a Minnesota-based firm,
correct,
but in New York. She, in a previous job at Microsoft, had a very interesting challenge, which I think has paid a lot of dividends, at least from the outside, which is she managed the IP licensing strategy for legal and corporate affairs, if I understand correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And Microsoft has a particularly, at this point, broad licensing approach, which involves some of what you would imagine of getting IP rights and then licensing them for money, but they also have a shared source program and a variety of ways in which they give away or tell you they will not sue you if you use their stuff, which is a very advanced IP strategy and one that is well worth studying in its own right. That is not why Lisa is here, though. She is a vice president and deputy general counsel in the business division at Microsoft, where she is managing affairs related to cloud computing, which is our topic for today. For anybody who was here at the Berkman Center a decade ago, one of the things that we puzzled over were a lot of questions, sort of basic law questions about what the internet might mean in the sense of civil procedure and jurisdiction. So if somebody does something bad and it happens to use the internet and it's a long way away, where do you sue someone? These were the first set of questions. We found lots of ways to try to answer that in the standard civil procedure mode. But basically anything you could think of was sort of got us interested in this topic. If you are worried about speech or privacy or whatever it might be, the internet messed up the equation from a lawyer's perspective. And in some ways we figured out how to solve a lot of those problems, worrying less about the internet and more about geographic grounding. Where did it happen? Where did the harm occur? And so forth. One of the things about cloud computing is it re-asks a lot of those questions. It blows up some of the structures, I think, that we've created that make it easier to talk about this, and re-raises many of the fascinating questions that got many of us interested in this a decade ago. So Lisa, to lead us into this direction, we're delighted to have you here and eager to hear what you have to say.
Thank you so much for that kind introduction. Thanks, everybody, for being here. I'm really excited about being able to have this conversation. I'll give a little bit more context just for background in terms of how I have to deal with some of these issues in my job today. So as the lawyer that manages the team for business division, that's the product group that creates things like Office and Exchange and SharePoint, and we have enterprise services that we're trying to launch for our customers. In effect, you know, take email and SharePoint and put them online and offer them as a service. And so that's just a little bit about the perspective that I come from with, you know, with respect to this particular issue. So not as much on the consumer side, more on the enterprise side, and it has slightly different issues. We at Microsoft are just very excited generally about the new era of cloud-based software plus services. And there are three aspects of it that I'd like to touch on a little bit today. One, give a little bit of a grounding in the technology and what it is, how we see it. Two, talk about the benefits that we see it bringing to customers. And then third, I'd like to touch on the legal and policy issues that we see this raising. The last topic is the one that I'd really like to spend most of our discussion time on today. And I also want to emphasize we're in the very early stages of our thinking about these issues. So I'd really appreciate, you know, your feedback and thoughts about how the industry should move forward in this regard. So just to kick off with the technology, over the past 60 years, there have been several significant transformations in computing. We first had the mainframe where, you know, computing was very expensive. It was the purview of large organizations and IT professionals. Then we had the 1980s and 90s. We had the rise of the PC. They became a lot more available, a lot easier to use. In effect, you know, computing was democratized during that era. Then around the turn of the century, we started to see sort of two different phenomena. One, the ability of small organizations through, you know, low-cost servers, in effect, to have their own data centers. They had their internal networks. And at the same time, there was the rise of the World Wide Web, which gave rise to unprecedented opportunities for collaboration and communication. And now we're seeing, in effect, what we're describing as the fourth era in cloud-based software plus services. And we think there are three technology trends that are really key to this new era. The first is the notion of people having many, many devices that they're using at once. So, you know, everybody here has a PC. People have a PC at work. You have oftentimes a small computing device to carry with you, right? A smartphone, potentially a PDA.
Occasionally a Mac.
Occasionally a Mac, that too. though we'll try to convert you. You might have a media center or a gaming device at home, which is getting more powerful. And you might have a GPS system in your car, which is getting more and more advanced. Now, as people are using these devices that are getting more powerful, they are storing more information, and they want to have them connected and synchronized all the time. And this is a particular challenge that cloud computing is uniquely situated to be able to solve. Second, we're also seeing the rise of more natural user interfaces. So, you know, today people are very comfortable using graphical user interfaces, which were a significant improvement, obviously, over command line interfaces. But we're starting to see things like touch-based manipulation. You might see that on your iPhone or your laptop. That's probably the furthest along in terms of natural user interfaces. But then there are other things like visual recognition and voice recognition that are coming into play as well. And then third, there's cloud computing itself. And in its simplest terms, this is really just providing software applications and computing power as a service over the internet, as opposed to, you know, using the power on your local device or your internal network. Now, the shift to cloud computing has many benefits. More choice and agility for customers in terms of how they deploy their infrastructure, for example. Potential cost savings because you have economies of scale through large data centers, and there's often times what they call a pay-as-you-go model. So this notion that you're going to pay for the computing power that you use, but not more. It also facilitates the ability to have your devices connected, and correspondingly enables us to be, you know, more productive and more competitive in the worldwide economy. And finally, it enables an unprecedented amount of access to an enormous amount of computing power. And this, you know, enables more people to have access to this computing power because it's much cheaper, giving rise to potentially more and more innovation than what we've seen before. We don't think about cloud computing at Microsoft, though, as an either-or proposition. Sometimes you hear people talking about, you know, it's going to be service-oriented and the desktop is going to go away. And we really do think that there's a combination here, that people are going to want to have a mixed environment. So we talk about it as software plus services because it's this choice between the ability to use power in the sky and on your desktops and your internal networks that gives people more agility in their environments. So let's look at a couple of examples in terms of how software plus services can be used. So for enterprises, for example, you might elect to keep certain sensitive data or things that are core business processes locally in your internal network, but then there might be other sort of very intensive IT infrastructure applications such as email or customer relationship databases or conferencing that you may decide to outsource. This can enable you to reduce cost, to scale your capacity needs up and down more quickly. And in that example, think about, you know, if you had to have additional hardware for conferencing. You don't have to buy a server, install it on your network, get it up and running. You basically can, with the click of a mouse, add more power to your services in the sky. And this enables the enterprises to focus more of their resources on their core competencies. Public sector customers, governments, also can realize a lot of these same benefits. So think about an agency that has an annual filing deadline, and you know, the 4 weeks, 2 weeks before that deadline, they might have peak capacity that they have to address. So again, cloud computing enables you to sort of buy the capacity that you need for that peak demand. I mean, one of the examples, think about like the US Census. That peak time when you're processing that power, you can just go and get that excess computing capacity that you need to do that particular job. Additionally, scientific research projects often require massive computing power, and because they have to process vast amounts of data, and that can be costly. So this is a way to enable governments to, in effect, outsource that need more cost effectively on a pay-for-what-you-go model. Finally, for developers, cloud computing offers new opportunities for them as well. So one of the announcements we just made at our professional developers conference back in the fall was about the Windows Azure development platform. So this is basically the operating system, in effect, the platform for the cloud and data centers. And we have .NET services components there that provides developers with the ability to basically reuse technologies that already exist to enable them to solve some of the more complex challenges of transferring data inside and outside the company. So think about this for a developer. They are able to basically reuse certain technologies. They don't have to devote as many resources to either code them or solve the problem. And so this enables them to basically get technologies to market more efficiently and to devote, you know, some of their limited resources in other aspects. And it also broadens their ability to expand the markets that they're targeting because they're getting to market more quickly and they hopefully have access to more customers. So I'm going to flip to a video just to attempt to make this more real. I'll also sort of put a little bit of a disclaimer on this. This is definitely a marketing video, but I wanted to show it because I think it does give people a sense about the vision and where we see this going. So you saw some of you saw each of the trends that I talked about in that video. You saw how multiple devices are connected between the phone and the gaming device and the PC. You saw the use of touch manipulation as a natural user interface. You saw a developer basically using the Windows Azure platform to launch their application, and then at the end when they were doing that dial. You saw how in one easy step, basically a developer was able to scale their platform to add more capacity. So that's just a little bit of a brief overview. I know we wanted to try to keep this to like a 20-minute kickoff. So with that, I'm going to turn to a few of the legal and policy issues that this gives rise to. So let me just start with a scenario. We've got a business that launches a conferencing and email service offering. So company is headquartered in the United States. That's the service provider. It's going to put data centers around the world for a variety of reasons. Their backup purposes, you know, you would definitely want to have your data backed up in multiple places. Their latency reasons. So sometimes, you know, if information takes too long to get back to the customer from the time they make their request, the business wants to actually move a data center closer to where that person is located. And there's also some dynamics with public sector customers. So there are a few things we're starting to see here. That public sector customers, when they're bidding out a service, for example, so they say, if you want to host my email, you've got to actually put a data center locally in my jurisdiction. So in some ways, it's becoming a new type of procurement preference. There are a couple reasons for this. Sometimes it's economic. From the perspective of the data centers bring some jobs with them, and public sector customers that are spending money on the service want to make sure that those jobs are located in their jurisdiction. And then there are also law enforcement reasons or national security reasons. So governments don't want to have their data, in effect, easily accessible in another jurisdiction. And sometimes they want to make sure their data is actually local to them so they can access it if they have law enforcement needs as well. Now, the service has enterprise and public sector customers all over the world, and then they have employees that are, you know, even outside, in effect, their home jurisdictions of all of these customers. So just looking at this slide, you know, gives rise to obviously an amazing number of jurisdictional issues across a wide variety of issues, the things that, you know, John was talking about. And we could spend hours, literally, I'm sure, talking about many of these. Privacy issues, security issues, law enforcement issues, issues around IP and hoster liability, the ability to run mixed source in a cloud environment, data portability, software converging with telecommunications, and what does that mean in a hosted environment. But there are two sets of issues that I thought this scenario highlighted that I was just going to dive in on a little bit more before we kicked off the discussion. So obviously the complex issues that borderless cloud computing in effect creates, and it's particularly acute when you think about the notion of moving data across borders. So very difficult issues can arise with respect to privacy, security, and law enforcement of multiple jurisdictions, each claiming that they own the right to regulate the particular scenario, and then having a situation where those laws, in effect, conflict. So in reality, then what happens with a service provider in a situation like this, if they can't feel like they can resolve the conflicting obligations, many times you just end up not launching a service because you can't make things mesh. Alternatively, and this depends definitely on the service, you might end up turning features on and off in particular jurisdictions. That doesn't always work for all technologies. Sometimes the technology doesn't map to that ability to be able to do that. And even if it does, you still have issues around losing some of your economies of scale, because think about how many times you may have to customize across how many different features. And so one of the real benefits of cloud computing in the economies of scale can be really lost. So, you know, as we start to think about these issues, it seems like governments are going to have to work together in sort of new ways to find practical solutions to these problems. It may be that there are different international rules that come into play, different types of coordination to basically address transfer and access to data that's moving across borders. It also might be that governments that, you know, figure out how to create rules that make it easier for a service provider to move data across their borders, they might have an advantage when it comes to attracting data centers to locate in their jurisdictions. A second issue that this scenario raises, particularly because I picked conferencing and email as a service, is how do the large bodies of traditional telecom regulations apply in this new world? This is particularly challenging, you know, and it comes up in the context of, you know, VoIP and conferencing, but we're also seeing it start to come up even with more traditional types of communications like email and instant messaging as these are expanding into more and more new markets. So there are a few issues that, you know, we have here. One is that these laws definitely vary quite a bit by jurisdiction. So that's first, you have all the jurisdictional issues. Secondly, you have bodies of regulation that were really written for very different technologies. And again, this isn't a new issue, but it's particularly acute in the telecom area as we try to think about how do those laws and regulations apply to these technologies, if at all. And then, even if they do apply, there's a real challenge for the technology provider to actually be able to provide some of the obligations. So things that often go along if you're classified at some level as a telecom service. You have some law enforcement type requirements. You might have emergency service type requirements like E911. You have different confidentiality obligations. You might have different tax and billing requirements. And, you know, one example of some of the challenges of technology, even in the United States, was when VoIP calling was introduced. E911, so the equivalent of the 911 service in telecoms, so it's the electronic version, when that was rolled out, there was really no technical solution that enabled a provider to actually satisfy the obligation that was being imposed on it. Now, again, these types of issues, and quite frankly, all of the other ones that I mentioned in the beginning, there really aren't clear answers to how to address, you know, how to address these. But I think they would all benefit from both more cross-industry and cross-industry government collaboration and discussion, because it seems like you have to find the balance between how do you promote some of these important social mandates and government interests, with at the same time trying to ensure that this new technology is still going to be able to evolve and be rolled out so that customers can get the benefits of it. So I'm just going to quickly touch on a little bit more detail on the first point of data movement before we get into the discussion, and this is to sort of make some of the examples more concrete. And I'll also say up front, I particularly picked these jurisdictions just because they set up some of the examples for discussions in a very explicit way. It's not that I'm an expert on the laws of the jurisdictions that I'm going to talk about, so don't ask me about Belgian law. So let's take a look first at data protection and data retention laws in the EU. So data protection laws, obviously, you know, are trying to ensure privacy of personally identifiable information. And they require that information is deleted when there's no longer a business purpose for keeping it. Data retention laws, generally for law enforcement purposes. And they require electronic communication services to hold data for between 6 months and 2 years, depending upon how the country elects to implement that. So here's a scenario. You've got a German company that's going to outsource its email business to a cloud service provider. And that service provider has a data center in France. The German company tells the provider, I basically, you know, have a six-month data retention policy, so I want my email deleted after 6 months. They have employees in France and Belgium, so some of those communications that are stored are between those employees, and again, they're being stored in France. So now we have a situation where the data retention laws of Germany basically say that communications information has to be kept for 6 months. In France, it's a one-year obligation, and in Belgium, it's two. So if the service provider ends up deleting the email in 6 months, whose law applies and kind of what are the obligations? Another scenario we've actually seen is customers that are asking for assurances about cloud service, basically when they use a cloud service, that they're not going to subject the data that they're storing to access by foreign governments. And in particular, we've seen this come up with customers wanting to avoid the application of the U.S. Patriot Act. That's generally the context that it arises. And now there are some provincial laws in British Columbia and Nova Scotia, for example, that say for public sector customers, if they're using a cloud service, their data actually has to be stored in Canada. It can't be stored outside of Canada. So if you have a situation where you've got a U.S. service provider who has a data center in the U.S., they can't store that data in Canada and satisfy the Canadian requirement. But even if they try to actually have a data center in Canada, while it might be, you know, technically possible to set this up in such a way that the U.S. Patriot Act might not apply, from a practical scenario, that's probably really difficult from a way a corporation sort of would run its business. And so you really may find yourself in a situation where you can't satisfy both obligations. So these are just two examples to sort of cue up the discussion. So with that, I will stop and see where people want to go with this.
Sounds great. It sounds to me a little bit like you're trying to get back at all your law school professors by coming up with a hypothetical. That sounds a fair amount like an exam question. But either in direct response to tricky exam questions or otherwise, who wants to jump in?
So thank you for the presentation. It's very interesting. And actually, I have more problems than questions.
So I'm gonna kick you back the ball. Because, for example, in data protection, I think is a good example, and European also, because I passed through a situation like that. Like while working at a telecom company, main office was in Spain, so it has this huge rules on data protection. And actually the mother company, it gets a lot of penalties about that. So how the idea is like how to structure in a strategic way that even if you respect the laws of your hosting country, you do not create this problems of penalty, you know, because we already have a lot of international private laws that deals with some kind of the issues like contracts and property, but this is not clear. So I don't know, have you faced any specific case where you the judicial solution was the mother company law regulates where your servidors go or how you develop your strategy where you put your servidors, or do you have any specific case that are like court result around these issues?
I would say actually a lot of these issues just aren't resolved. Okay. So let me, I'll just tell you a little bit about another real world example. One of the real issues we face is when we decide to put a data center in a country and put personally identifiable information there. I mean, we go through a very extensive process to ensure that we're not going to find ourselves in effect a situation of conflicting laws, because there isn't a great way to resolve some of those issues now. And I can just talk about one statute that, you know, we came across in doing some research on Japan. In particular, it talks about electronic communications not being able to basically be transferred outside the country. So you go back again to, you know, the conflict with potentially obligations under U.S. law enforcement. And, you know, you can talk to people in the country and sort of find out a little bit more about how does this really apply. And it turns out, well, to deal with local law enforcement requests, everybody kind of understands that that's okay. Beyond that, not a lot of case law. You don't get a ton of comfort. Some people will tell you, well, maybe there's this other practice that it lets a subsidiary company transfer information to a parent without violating the law. But, you know, if you're a service provider trying to make decisions, and like you said, there may be sort of additional penalties or criminal liability, you want to make sure that you know what you're getting into going in. And so, you know, one of the things that we're starting to think about is if this web of the laws are what, you know, cause a lot of the conflicts, you know, is there some different process that we should be thinking about to try to get these issues sort of resolved and clarified in a new way, so before somebody actually launches in a country, they can get some clarity? Should we be looking more at treaty-like solutions? You know, I mean, the whole concept of safe harbor, for example, for moving data from Europe to the United States, I mean, that's something that's workable and has worked well. I mean, is that something we should be building on?
pass the gene code, please?
Sure. So you talked about basically condoned outsourcing. When a government or a corporation intentionally goes and outsources their email functions, for example. But what, you know, it is always one of the things that you're saying about cloud computing is that it is everywhere and it's so easy to just do it on your own as a private, well, not as a private person, but as a person who's employed. So if you're trying to do something like fire attorneys generals or you know, state troopers, and you decide not to use governmental email systems and use some other email system, are you then... Do you, as the provider of that service, are you at some point obligated to kind of go to the lowest, or I guess the highest common denominator amongst all of the different privacy and retention policies that are out there, knowing that it just seems like it would be almost impossible for a corporation or government to stop its employees from using these systems? They can't even take President Obama's BlackBerry away. So, I mean, how would you deal with that in terms of kind of non-sanctioned use of cloud computing? And that would include documents and all those other things, not just email.
Yeah, let me see if I can answer sort of part of that question. Again, I don't think there are clear answers. To the extent that you can have a high watermark, that's obviously a much more potentially workable solution than when you have laws that are just outright conflicting. So, you know, from what we've seen in privacy, for example, as compared to telecommunications, it looks like there's at least a little bit more of a path to being able to have a high watermark on privacy. When you start to get to things like telecommunications or even, I'd say, something like data security, and we're starting to see there some statutes both at the state level and at the country level to get very, very specific about how you have to protect data. And to the extent those things start to conflict, you're in a situation that you can't have a high watermark that satisfies everybody. And then that's added even more complexity when you start saying you have to deal with data by, you know, where the person is a resident of, as opposed to, you know, where the data is located or where the company is located. So very complex sort of issues. I mean, I'll turn the question back. I mean, do you have any thoughts on, you know, how do you sort of drive to a high watermark or some more consistency? Or are there aspects that you think that a high watermark would be more amenable to, you know, aspects of the issues?
Well, right. So I think from it seems like there's the legal perspective of how would you make those all comport with each other. And then obviously within each industry or the government, there would be personnel policies about using these. And then there's also the kind of how, if it became a criminal investigation, how you would then go around digging the data out. It seems like you can't stop malfeasance, but maybe there's ways to kind of make it more to, I guess I'm actually a little bit more interested in almost the cultural questions of how would you help explain to employees that these may not be condoned. You're actually doing an explicit bypassing of systems. Or else maybe you as the provider would end up being stuck with that high watermark, which is something I don't think that would be a happy scenario for the rest of us who just want to use, you know, Hotmail or whatever.
There's quite a line, so I want to get to Chris, then Darius, then Ethan, and Caroline will go come back to you after that, if that's okay.
Hi. So as a user of Microsoft Word, if I create a document on my computer and the police or the FBI would like to get at it at some point, they have to go before a judge and prove probable cause and get a warrant and then search my home and take my computer. If I'm a user of Microsoft Office Live, your cloud computing approach, either in the business sphere or for personal use, and I create a document and the FBI or the police would like to get a copy of it, they need a subpoena, which doesn't require that they go before a judge and doesn't require that they meet the probable cause benchmark. I guess my question relates to that. You know, we're seeing these really low-cost computers now that are shipping with Google Docs or Microsoft Live Office or Microsoft Office Live links on the desktop. And I'm concerned that many users, you know, they click on the icon that has a picture of a notepad and a pen, and they double-click on that, and it starts up, and they start writing. And it might not be clear to them that, one, they're using an online program, especially now that we have some offline storage tools like Google Docs and Google Gears. So the first is that they may not be even realize that they're using it online, and the second is that they may not realize that they lack significant legal protection with regards to the privacy of their documents. So my question is this an issue that Microsoft cares about? And secondly, what is Microsoft doing to communicate the severity of the situation to users and educate them of their significantly lesser legal rights online?
And Chris's views are communicated in part by the back of his laptop. Yeah.
So great feedback and great question. You know, I think that it is, we would hope, though totally open to feedback, that it is apparent to users that they are storing documents online and not in their computer when they're storing things on Office Live. But if they're, you know, the whole concept of notice to users, we have terms of use which do address things like, you know, consent to having to deal with law enforcement issues. So those are things we try to address in a responsible way in our terms of use and just generally as the service is presented to users. But if there are specific things that when you say you've used it and gosh, you guys aren't showing enough about how this is going to work, we'd totally like to hear that feedback.
Well, I mean, I'm a technically savvy user, and I haven't read the terms of use. And I doubt anyone in this room has read the terms of use, even for the Microsoft Office traditionally installed product. I don't know if embedding that kind of information on line 500 of your terms of use is really sufficient.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you mentioned that you sort of suffer from divergent laws in privacy, data protection, data retention, telecommunications in Europe, for instance. Mm-hmm. Even though in Europe these laws are pretty well harmonized, after all, but there is sort of flip side that you didn't mention, and it's interoperability. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at it from the European perspective, mm-hmm. and there are some facts that might matter here. And it's that in 2001, there was this antitrust investigation mm-hmm. against Microsoft started. And on the surface, it was about media player and the PCOS. But in fact, it was about your licensing policy towards interoperability information. So in 2004, the European Commission decided that there was infringement in this case and obliged you to reveal the information or at least to change your licensing policy. Microsoft didn't comply. In 2006, there was the first fine. Actually, in 50 years of antitrust proceedings in the European Union, that was the first time when the Commission needed to use this tool. So there was a fine for non-compliance mm-hmm. With the decision.
Is there a question coming?
It was 300 million, I guess. In 2007, the European Court of Justice vindicated the decision of the Commission. And in February 2008, if I'm not wrong, there was another fine, almost billion euros. Right, so that was a very expensive case for you, for the European mm-hmm. Commission. My friends in the European Commission said, well, it ate most of our budget, mm-hmm. this one case. That was a burden for the court in Luxembourg. What is really surprising to me is, and interoperability was a common thread of you know all these proceedings. In April 2008, another two cases were open. Mm-hmm. One regarding Microsoft Office, the other where Opera was a complainant. So I guess you know it seems to me like a never-ending story, and interoperability also seems to me as something very important in cloud computing area, right? So what's your attitude as lawyer, as somebody who would like to have good relationships, relationship with regulators and comply with law? Mm-hmm. What's your attitude towards it?
So I will say we take our obligations under the law, you know, very seriously. We, as a company, have been very committed to interoperability as a general matter. About a year ago, we announced interoperability principles, something Ray Ozzie was very involved with. One thing that you didn't mention in the case, one part of that is still on appeal on the fine scenario. But you're right. I mean, in the world of cloud computing, interoperability is important as well. And there are many aspects to that. So let me talk a little bit about some of the things that, you know, we've already focused on with respect to the Windows Azure platform. Right now it's in a technology preview stage, and it works with Visual Studio and some of the Microsoft languages for developers to write. But it's when it launches, I mean, the goal is to have this support and work with non-Microsoft languages such as Python and PHP, and in non-Microsoft development environments such as Eclipse. Secondly, it's also built on standard protocols. And so the goal there is that, you know, regardless of whether the application that's communicating with it is built on Linux or you know, runs on other operating systems, that it too can benefit from those services. And the whole issue of, you know, data portability is one that, quite frankly, the industry, I think, would benefit from continuing to talk about, because customers, you know, if I'm a customer and I'm going to put my data in the cloud, if I change my mind and want to bring it back on premises, they want to know they can get it back. Or if they want to move it between the clouds. And so I definitely agree that that whole concept is something that would definitely benefit from more focus in the industry.
So Ethan, then back to you. Ethan is next, please. Thank you.
Thanks for being here. And that's a fun set of issues to put on the table. As much as I love these sort of complex jurisdictional questions, I'm not a lawyer, and I tend to approach this stuff from the user frame point. And in my experience, generally speaking, the user in a cloud environment or even in a server environment tends not to have much leverage. And just to give you sort of an example of something going on right now, most of my work is focused on human rights and media in the developing world. I have a nonprofit organization in Zimbabwe that recently got kicked off their web host after 4 years, because their web host woke up, discovered they were in Zimbabwe, incorrectly interpreted the US Treasury Department's regulations on Zimbabwe, concluded they couldn't do business with any Zimbabweans, including the folks trying to overthrow the government, and throw them off their server on the same week that we had the biggest news in Zimbabwe in a year, which is the joint government. Gone back and forth, brought in embassies. Ultimately, the customer has literally no power at all in this scenario. So I think one of the scenarios that I worry about in a cloud computing environment is that for people who are very concerned about human rights, people who are very concerned about data protection, so on and so forth, the early indications are that we should run like hell from this. And it's problematic because it's clear that from a technical point of view, this is a great way to do things. I would so much rather host my server where someone has 100 sysadmins who are on call on rollerblades and can swap hard drives in and out than run it out of my basement. But unless large companies running clouds can offer an assurance, not just that they're going to harmonize laws, but that they're actually going to dig in their heels and actually fight for the rights of customers, the response from at least some class of consumers is going to be to say, over my dead body. So I'm very curious, sort of beyond this question of harmonizing, how this comes into issues of free speech, how this comes into issues of rights of expression. What's the responsibility of a corporation like Microsoft to act as a defender of those rights within a cloud space?
So this fall, we participated in the launch of the global network initiative around freedom of privacy and freedom of expression, which I believe people in this organization were involved in. And that's definitely one vehicle that, that we see, particularly in the more consumer-oriented services that you're talking about, of helping to advance privacy, freedom of expression, dealing with law enforcement issues in an appropriate way, trying to have them narrowed to the extent possible, giving notice to users. And I do think sort of that industry, NGO, cross-collaboration approach is going to be very important for those types of issues. Let me just shift also to the enterprise customers, though. Enterprise customers, I think, would maybe classify the situation a little bit differently. I mean, they are certainly asking in the enterprise world to impose very specific types of obligations on the service provider for a wide variety of issues, whether it's, you have to set up your physical security in a certain way. You have to talk about like deleting data in a certain way, host it in a certain spot. So those, at least at the enterprise level, those issues are definitely being, you know, negotiated on a contract by contract basis.
I just had an observation. I don't see any databases, I mean, in any of these trouble areas on the map. Is that because of...
Oh, no, actually...
This is a hypothetical, man.
That's totally a hypothetical.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, honestly, the reason why we had picked those jurisdictions and I didn't when we were trying to cut down the speech, we actually had scenarios between, you know, Spain and Argentina and the United States and India because they had some interesting scenarios. So that was just why. No, that was the reason.
It's just it's a question actually that's related to it and question, and but it's a specific one. Is there any program related to like some social responsibility that Microsoft is developing? Because for example, when you think about cloud and computing has one of the ways to have ICT for development. For example, in the Global Development Commons that USAID is developing, they are trying to use the strategy of cloud and computing to guarantee space for one of the ideas we were discussing, to guarantee space for this kind of NGOs and for movements that sometimes they don't have money to hire the services, but they need this kind of service. So, for example, how to share these resources in a social responsible way and include and guarantee this access that Ethan was talking about.
So I think there are potentially two aspects to that. One, I mean, you could start at a very basic level of broadband access, right? So for people to be able to use this, both to post and host data up there and to access it, you need to have broadband access. And so that starts to get into potentially a discussion around, you know, are there incentives that the government can provide to help that be built out, and in the interim, are there, you know, policies around at least trying to create hubs, if you would, in communities if there's not, you know, very dispersed broadband access available. The flip side, I think, what you're asking about with sort of cost of the service, if you would, you know, I think at a general level, the concept of pay as you go should hopefully help that. So it's not like you have this huge investment in, you know, a huge server farm up front in this model. And so ideally the pay as you go model would, you know, help that. Beyond that, I don't really have any, you know, specifics to talk to you about now, but I could, you know, just analogizing to our software, you know, we have a lot of programs which enable our in-the-box software to be available, you know, in to NGOs and to poor communities at very cheap prices. So that's good feedback and something we should think about.
Can the terms of use of the service provider reference explicitly the terms of use of the cloud infrastructure provider? Is that a sensible solution to anything?
So are you thinking about like the person who creates the application and what kind, and do they carry through? So if I'm a developer and I post on the cloud, does that developer carry through the terms of service of the service provider, if you would?
Yes, if that developer has that service, has terms of use associated with their particular business. And then within those terms, they also reference rather than incorporate the service providers of Azure or Amazon as cloud services providers. Does that solve any problem?
I'm sorry, I don't understand referencing versus incorporating, though. What do you mean by the distinction? Because often you...
At the very top of specifically our terms of use, we basically say this incorporates, I don't know if that's the right legal language, the terms of use of Amazon Web Services with a link directly to the terms of use of Amazon Web Services.
So that's usually called incorporation by reference, right? So I'm trying to understand. So that one we get, which is you incorporate them by reference. You say we get. What is there a distinction when you're just referencing and not incorporating that you're trying to get at?
No, I'm asking if I'm not a liar. I'm a doctor. If that solves any particular problem of the kind that are being discussed here.
I wouldn't say it necessarily solves things. It's certainly one option, and different providers take different approaches. For example, there are some service providers that require that, and that often has to do with impacting what the service provider can actually do with the data that's hosted. Other times, you can take an approach that basically says to the developer, you can have your own terms of use. So I think there are multiple options that can be used, and it really depends on what the service provider is trying to achieve from a business standpoint.
May I have some questions on business models? So for Amazon, they have EC2 and AS3, and at least contribute deals into their financial reports already. But for Google, application engine, they have a lot of community support right now. But for Microsoft, what kind of predictions or maybe the roadmap in your mind? How can you really deploy the service to public and have the developer community or the business community to support it? And what's the financial projections or maybe the expectations? Yeah.
So we haven't made any financial projections about what is this going to mean. In terms of a business model, the community preview stage, things were very up in the air, and we were just talking to people and saying we want to take feedback from people as they're using it, and we'll talk more about what the business model will be probably this year, quite frankly. I think there's definitely some notion of pay as you go, so some concept of that based on use, but the specifics of that haven't been determined yet.
So I might take the moderator's prerogative, and I'll pass it to David and Sarah after that, but I want to just not lose the thread of the Global Network Initiative, which you brought up and referenced here. I think as everybody in the Berkman community knows, we were involved in this from the start in the secret phases and wrote some of the initial documents for it, and have through Colin McClay and Caroline Nolan's leadership been involved all the way to the announcement of it, and will continue to be. And for the record, Chuck Kossin of Microsoft has been really a leader in raising the bar at every stage. I think I'm not betraying internal conversations by saying he's always been making the bar higher for human rights and free expression, a very important thing. Just to put it as crisply as possible, though, in the form of a difficult question, I think this makes it much harder for you to have such a high bar in implementing the GNI. Mm-hmm. So the basic idea, of course, with the GNI is that lots of companies, Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, and others who have signed on to it, when they're operating in another country, either before they get there or once they're in the country, will hew to a line for to protect human rights in the form of speech and privacy. To the extent that this model makes some of the presumptions we had for the earlier computing infrastructure go away, I think it will make it much harder to comply with the GNI. So I would just be interested in the how you're handling this conflict as it emerges, which is being a leader in pushing speech and privacy as a commitment, but then also advancing a computing platform that may well make it much harder for you to implement those principles as we go ahead.
Yeah, and both of these are relatively new. So I would say, we're in the early implementation phases. So we're going to have to think through those. I don't have any quick answers for you right now, but we are committed to the GNI, and there is a process, in that for further conversations about how to, best adjust things as technology changes and the environment changes.
David Weinberg.
Hi. yes, thanks very much for coming also. You mentioned in passing as one of the possible approaches is should Microsoft be engaged in some type of pushing for some type of treaty solution? Mm-hmm. What type of treaty would address this adequately?
I was literally starting this for conversation. If we had the answer, I think we'd be trying to figure out how to get some support behind it. There are just so many different issues. Between dealing with the law enforcement issues and the data retention, the data privacy issues, that it is unbelievably complex. And you add in things like telecom and security, physical security as well. It starts to look quite daunting. So I think the question is there a place maybe to start to test the waters? Is there a place that's easier to get something done first?
I'm interested in knowing from a business model point of view, if you've consulted with other firms that are confronting some of the similar issues with respect to treaties and international governance, specifically, for example, Akamai Technologies, that has a similar type of distributed network worldwide and might be similarly subject to them. So have you kind of looked at those business models yet and how they've dealt with it? And if so, like, how are you, how do you relate to their current models?
Not as specifically as, you know, saying, yes, we've looked at Akamai. We have looked at what other companies do. Wouldn't say there's necessarily a consistency in approach. So this would be something that I do think, to the extent that we can have more sort of cross-industry discussion on, we would probably benefit from.
Looking at the map, most of those countries,
I think, using, and I'm not a lawyer, but they're using Roman law instead of English law. So I don't quite understand when you're talking about referring to the case law. How would it apply?
Well, certainly case law would apply in the United States, for instance.
Right, but the rest of the map.
So is the question about how you would, different legal systems would be reconciled?
No, but you said since most of the law is not clearly established, one of the references you would use quite strongly is case law.
So that's me being, that was me speaking more from a U.S. perspective. In other contexts, a lot of times, practically, what you do is you go and talk to various regulators to try to understand how are they thinking about applying something. So, for example, I'll give you a telecoms type scenario in with live meeting. That's a conferencing service that we have. And it had a feature where you can have people who call in on a typical phone network connect to people who were watching a web conference, in effect, through VoIP. That feature was one where when you looked, particularly in France and Germany, you kind of said, wow, this might trigger being categorized as an electronic communication service, which, you know, in those countries, they have sort of the span of being what they call a PATS, which is more like a traditional telecom provider, and then they have information services, which are unregulated, and then this ECS category, which is in between. So that would be a scenario where we actually talked with regulators in both of those jurisdictions saying, how do you think about this law being applied to this scenario? French looked at it and said, we agree with you. We don't think this is an ECS. German regulators looked at it and said to us, you know, we're not really sure. And sort of the result of that for us was we were able to launch the feature in France and we turned off the feature in Germany. But that was my inappropriate sort of shorthand.
I have one more question, but does anybody else want to sneak one in before the close? He has not had a chance. Just making sure we have hands going.
I'll throw another one at you.
All right, Chris Seguin gets second to last, and then I will. Yes, you may.
So this is actually a question about Hotmail, but it's sort of cloud computing. And Microsoft Live for Office Live for consumers, not the business program. So for the last two summers in a row at the DEF CON Hacker Conference, people have released off-the-shelf tools that allow someone in a coffee shop to steal the session cookies from a user. This means that someone sitting next to you can then log in to your Hotmail account or log in to your Microsoft Office Live account after you've left the room. Now, they're not targeting Microsoft. It works for Gmail and Yahoo and Basic and Facebook and everyone else who's using these things. And I want to be careful to note that this isn't about stealing passwords. This is because you guys do use what's called SSL encryption to encrypt the password and the username, and then you give a cookie that then gets sent in plain text. So the question is, why are you still not using SSL, which is used for credit cards and everything else on the internet? Why are you still not using that for people's email for the entire session?
I'm going to have to get back to you on
that one. A different private group.
Technical question.
Or Microsoft Office Live for consumers?
You know what? Why don't you give me your card, and I'll see if I can find somebody from a technical standpoint that can help answer that question.
And you should also know that Chris has a hat as a journalist, so he's just one of the CNET bloggers, so it may also be.
That's final.
irrelevant point. So I just wanted to end with a statement slash question, which I think in the spirit of some of these statements slash questions that have come before, we at the Berkman Center pride ourselves both on having great relationships with lots of parties from all sides of this, and you guys in particular, but also in talking very straight about these things. And I think I've heard from my colleagues here, but also in thinking about cloud computing, that, you know, from the perspective of the slide for business, it's very easy to have the value propositions on that side of the ledger. From the value proposition, particularly from users who have less money, to put it frankly, which often means developing countries and so forth, I think it's a lot harder to make that slide other than free or cheap services, right? And I think our experience in the last decade has been free or cheap services of the Yahoo Mail in Hong Kong variety have caused some big problems when they've been rolled out to people without all that much disclosure about what could happen in using it. And I think from where we sit, I think I can channel some of the spirit, at least, of the room, that slide, the end user slide, other than lower cost and we all benefit from innovation, the sort of derivatives of your other slide, is much harder to put up. And that, as this rolls out, particularly where it's more question marks than anything, it's not obvious to me that this infrastructure means fewer civil liberties or less protection. I think it's likely, but we don't know yet. It's more in the question mark zone. But it's going very quickly, and you guys are now well into the mode and driving things forward. So I guess the question slash statement to end on, we have a building over there going up, a huge building, the northwest corner of the Harvard Law School, enormous thing. And one of the things in putting it up, it's a great thing for the school, but there's a huge mitigation plan, right? Everywhere you see signs that say, we know that this is disruptive or it may cause some bad things. With any big environmental development, of course, you have mitigation plans, right? It seems to me one thing that might help a lot for understanding this would be a sense that Microsoft, in rolling out this huge thing, had a mitigation plan in effect. The GNI is part of that. It's based, I think, broadly saying, as we go into new markets, we're going to ensure that we protect privacy and speech and so forth. That's a very explicit thing. But I think, I guess the question, but urging you to do it too, is what would the mitigation plan look like if you accept my premise that this is great for business, maybe good for the economy as a whole, not in every individual micro sense going to be good for end users, particularly end users who are getting cheap PCs with a link on them to the cloud without ever reading the terms of service or privacy policy, which we know nobody does even when they do it for a living. So what's the mitigation strategy, and is that a reasonable way to think about it?
I think on that one, I'll defer that to we'll take that one back for discussion, back in Redmond. I haven't spent as much time personally thinking about the consumer slant. I said I had spent more time sort of thinking about this from an enterprise scenario, but what I may do is get some of our folks who spend more time on the consumer aspects, if you don't mind, to connect back with you.
Right. Well, thank you guys, everyone, for a very spirited session, as always, and Lisa for subjecting yourself to our straight shooting approach to this. We're very glad to have a preview and look forward to seeing where you come out on all those issues.
Thanks so much.